Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, indeed, it's Professor Buzzkill, and we have a special episode today. Evan Axelbank is on the line. He is, of course, as you, so many of you know, the producer and the host of Axelbank Reports History In Today, interviews lots of great historians whose new books are influencing not only the way we think about history, but the way we think about how things are going on in the world today. So hello and welcome to Professor Buzzkill.
Well, it's such a treat to be on this sort of joint episode for a couple of reasons. One is because it's nice to just talk to another podcaster, but it's also nice for me because I spend so much of my time interviewing people, not only for this podcast, but for my day job. To kind of seed the ground a little bit and throw it out to another interviewer to listen to how you do your interviews and to just explore this medium that we're both involved in and both enjoying.
That's right, and both of our audiences can start to, well, I should say each of our audiences can start following the others podcast and go from there. And we should tell folks that what we're doing here is we're going to ask each other. We decided in secret to write 10 questions each for the other person, and that we neither of us knows which ones we're going to get, and we're going to ask them back and forth to each other, which I hope the questions are going to be a mix of what podcasting is like, but also what history is like and how history and podcasting work together.
Yeah.
So it'll
good.
Be
that's
about,
what I planned also. So that's good. Yeah, that's good.
So you didn't write me any baseball questions, which is depressing, but you know.
Oh, we can talk baseball too. I didn't even know you were a baseball fan, so we can talk baseball.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. One of my questions is about that in your career, but we're going to keep that quiet until the end. That's my 10th question.
Okay.
So Buzzkillers and Axel fans, we're going to go back and forth. So, let me first introduce Professor Buzzkill as a show and as a concept. It's a show that's been around for 5 years. In fact, we're in our sixth year. I started it in the relatively early days of podcasting because I was changing careers, and my students had always called me Professor Buzzkill. They would come in before class with these things they had pulled off the internet. You know, did Churchill say this? Is this true? I found this on an email. And of course, I was always saying, no, that's a myth. But then in class, I started to use those myths as a starting point or a hook to expand. Okay, well, let's look at the Munich crisis and World War II and what all that means, you know. So I realized that it was a way to get students' attention and sort of keep their attention on the important thing, not on the myth. And then they could go home and over Thanksgiving when their nutty uncle says, you know, blah, 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 they can say, well, no, actually, that's not true. That's a very common myth. And here's the blah, 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 and here's the background. And they can
be the star of the dinner table.
Absolutely. They can. We thought about subtitling it Roast Your Relatives, but we didn't.
That's so, roast your uncle.
And we've been, I think, very successful. We're one of the top history podcasts in terms of numbers. And I'm having a blast. So
yeah,
tell us about your wonderful podcast, which I listen to all the time.
It's my pleasure to do that. But I'm amazed at how well your podcast does. You have such a great following and so many followers on social media. It's really fantastic. And I listen to it, and it's really a lot of fun because myths are just not helpful.
And no, not at all.
So it's great that you're doing the myth busting because, you know, if you think about it, probably 90% of people out there have at least one myth that they hold as truth in their head, or maybe more. Maybe everybody has one.
And I still have them.
Sure, you
know, I have to always double check.
Absolutely. So it's great that you're focused on doing that. My show is much newer and has many fewer followers, and is one that I don't think ever really planned on doing. But I have a big reading habit. I read a ton of history books, and I think there was a point not that long ago, maybe 6 months ago, where I said to myself, you know, I wonder if there'd be a way to do more with this hobby, to bring all the books that I'm reading and what's been kind of stored in my head here out into a more a broad audience and a space where I could actually do some good with it. Because the reading thing, I guess, became sort of like an OCD type hobby for me, where I was just reading page after page after page. And that's great and helpful. And it helped me in my day job as a news reporter, because you have a great background on what's going on and how things have developed and evolved into where they are now with the historical background. That's something that I don't know that a ton of people have in any field. So it was really a lot of, it was always helpful for me to have a historical background. And I've always loved politics, and my history professors in college and political professors in college and things like that. But it was just fun for me to start to get this idea of, boy, maybe I could do a little bit more with the reading and make a show and help people mm-hmm. understand the way things have evolved in this country in very complicated and sometimes messy fashion. And so to be able to bring history to what we're thinking about every day, especially in times as complicated as these, although times, I guess, are always complicated. That's one thing you learn from history.
Yeah.
But there's no dear dim past where everything was nice and neat and clean and everything was simple. That certainly doesn't exist. You learn that. I have a great time interviewing, and I interview a ton for my day job. And this was just sort of a natural fit for me. So I got a logo made from a friend of mine. I got some intro music made from a friend of mine, and here it was. The great thing about podcasting is it doesn't take a whole lot to start up, but I will say it does take a lot to keep it going.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's kind of how the show started, and it's been a lot of fun. The authors have been willing to come on and do it. And one of the things is I take a bit of a different approach than you, because you do a lot of editing and a lot of precision, and I do want to ask you about that. But I just kind of do an interview, and I spend 45 minutes with somebody, interview them. Very few edits are made, almost none. Unless there's a siren that goes by or we have to stop for something or something like that, I put the intro music on and off it goes out into the world. That's just the way I've chosen to do it. I don't know that either is right or wrong, but that's just the way that I've decided. So anyway, that's how Axel Bank Reports History and Today have started. And I have to thank the guests that have come on too, because, they have been, even for a new show, best-selling authors have been willing to come on, and that's really cool. So anyway.
Yeah, that really makes the show, and it makes my show too when I'm able to get them on. Well, this leads into my first question for you. Can we start with the
Please?
Questions?
Yeah, then? We got 10 questions. We'll go back and forth. And we haven't told questions.
It's a complete secret. Your show really is, why I like it, why I was so drawn to it, is it's really about reading. Yes, there are a lot of book shows out there, a lot of political shows, a lot of history shows, but it's very obvious that you have been reading, and you mentioned this in the OCD comment a moment ago, you've been reading serious books a long time. My first question is, how young were you when you started reading these serious books?
That's a great question. Growing up, I was into the sort of quick hit sports books, the ones that like young boys tend to be involved in, although I don't think that they should just be marketed to boys, to be clear on that. I think everybody should read sports books because they're great lessons and because everybody likes sports. But I guess for whatever reason, I got into those Matt Christopher books and the books about kids where something extraordinary would happen to them while they're playing. The kid hits 50 home runs in a row or something like that. But reading, I never really considered it a big part of my sort of my main interests. I guess I was off doing other things, but I spent a lot of time on the subway growing up. I spent a lot of time. Oh. Yeah. I spent a lot of time going from the Bronx to Manhattan for high school. And when you spend 45, 50 minutes on a subway, I remember reading Time magazine. I remember reading Newsweek. And I believe that the first serious book that I read was Evan Thomas's book about Bobby Kennedy. But it also could have been, for whatever reason, a book about the killing of JonBenet Ramsey. That was a big story at the time in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And I would read these books on the subway, but I'm pretty sure it was the RFK book. And I just fell in love. I did. I fell in love with it. And it became something that I was like, oh, I want to read it. I want to read another one. And it I remember feeling very good about opening up the book and holding the book and what a new book feels like in your hands. And you start to turn the pages and get involved in this person's life and to find out about it. So I remember that. But then I will say it really took on a life of its own in 02 when Robert Caro's Master of the Senate came out, and I was assigned to read the first chapter for a class on legislative behavior.
Right,
I'm still
okay.
I'm still in
this
touch
is
with
the part of the biography of LBJ.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Right. Master of the Senate, but about in the Years of Lyndon Johnson series by Robert Caro. And I was just transfixed by the first chapter of that book. I was just stunned by how great it was and how great the writing was. And it was a hobby ever since.
Let me, with a follow-up question, just take you quickly back to that subway. You very cleverly avoided giving your age. What was the actual age?
I'm happy
you were riding, first of all, riding the subway, and second of all, reading Time and Newsweek on the subway.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Great question. I didn't hide it on purpose.
yes, you did.
I was a high school student. And so I remember, I believe I took a school bus to school in eighth grade, but rode the subway back. But then in high school, starting in ninth grade, so I was 14, I was going back and forth on the subway to and from school 45 minutes a day. Now, I did ride with a friend or two, but not every day. Sometimes someone would, you know, not be at school or different different times or whatever. But I was 14 in 97. So Time and Newsweek probably started at some point in there. And I always knew I wanted to get into the news business. So this seemed like a way to beef up and to really know what was going on. Time and Newsweek, and then starting to read books after that. And it just became a lifelong hobby. My goodness, I'm 37 now, so it's 23 years since those early days on the subway. A lot happens on that subway. You know, reading is a good way to, you know, put yourself, you know, put your head down and not think about what's going on around you.
Well, and it was before iPods and iPhones, and you couldn't just
relax with your music.
Yeah.
I probably had a Discman, and when the iPods first started, I probably in the early 2000s, like maybe in the year 2000 or 99 or 2000, there was a big crime surge on the subways because of that.
It was
actually probably the main reason for it. Everyone wanted iPods. So anyway, can I give you your first question?
Yeah, let's go. Yeah.
So you're, of course, Professor Buzzkill. Mm-hmm. So in what ways is teaching history to a class similar or different from trying to bring it history to a podcast audience?
Well, in some ways it's similar, because I've always from the very beginning when I started teaching, tried to have a hook at the beginning to get people interested, not just walk in and say, okay, let's talk about Tacitus and the Roman Empire. I try not to make it overly dramatic or overly simplified, but often with, say, there'd be a movie out and I could say, there are endless World War II movies coming out, and I would talk about D-Day by saying, well, if you've been out and you've seen Saving Ryan's Privates, then you know this about Omaha, and this is what really happened. So that helped a lot. It's different because, of course, you don't have to, and yet you have to constantly engage with students nowadays. I'm constantly saying, you know, every two sentences, three sentences, are you with me? Okay, well, I just said something you probably never heard before. What is that? What do you think that means? And with podcasts, of course, you don't do that. That back and forth comes later.
They can't ask questions in real time. Yeah.
Right. But I think both types of delivery formats have helped. Well, each delivery format has helped the other. I don't know if I've become a better teacher because I'm also a podcaster, but I know that it was probably easier for me to start a podcast because I was already used to teaching and talking more or less, talking in coherent sentences and delivering a lecture.
Do you feel as comfortable behind a mic as you do in front of the class?
Oh, it's so much more comfortable behind the mic now. Oh, it's 1,000 times more comfortable.
Is it because the eyes are not looking at you?
I guess when I'm teaching, which is not all the time now, days, I'm terrified, absolutely terrified. Maybe that's because I'm of an older generation than you are, and I used to be, hyper-confident when I was younger, and maybe I'm starting to question my abilities as I get older, but podcasting's a lot easier.
Interesting.
I think it's a lot easier.
And you're your own boss. All right, I'll ask the second question at some level. I'll ask the second question, and then you can come back. So I'll start the next round here. One of the things I love about your show is that it is so carefully done that you can tell that you put such time into the mechanics of the editing and of the way it sounds and of how precise the language is that you use. And it's just not a style that I do. I just don't, it's just not the way I've set up the show. So why do you insist on such diligence in the technical quality of your product?
Well, there's an easy answer in one sense. And when we started off, I don't know why I had this flash of insight, but I decided to do a Kickstarter to raise funds because I knew that equipment would be important. And very fortunately, I live in Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh is one of the big centers for podcasts in the country. That Libsyn, the biggest podcast distributor, is here. There are a number of Pittsburgh production companies that do podcasts for worldwide distribution. And I lucked into meeting some podcast engineers who said, well, you need to get these microphones and these. And so we spent all the money basically on equipment. So that's one answer. But the other thing is I thought no one in the world is going to want to listen to my podcast and listen to me talk about history like I talk about it in a class. No one, you know, so no one's going to want to hear. We did our very, very first show on the myth of J. Edgar Hoover being a cross-dresser.
That was a myth, but okay.
Yeah.
Now I do.
That's
for another time, though.
The only way we're going to get people interested in the show, the only way we get people to listen consistently is to, you know, we'll bring in a panel. We'll bring in some comedians, some this and that, and, you know, we'll make it fun. And we did that, and it was a tremendous failure. The first, it wasn't anybody's fault that these people were doing what they were supposed to do, but my early fans started to say, well, actually, we want to hear more from you. We want to hear more from the professor. We don't want to hear relatively lame jokes about J. Edgar Hoover's cross-dressing. And so that's when I thought, oh, okay. And I was very heartened by that because what it said to me was, no, I was wrong. People don't need the joke just to get to the serious stuff. They want the serious stuff. So that raised my opinion of sort of the American public, the audience's, you know, appetite for serious things. And then what I'm getting to is then I decided I had to, because I tried various ways of making general outlines and just talking off my top of my head, and they were all terrible. And so from then on, and this was 2015 onwards, my shows were absolutely scripted, word for word. Except when I'm interviewing someone, and even then I have a strong outline, a detailed outline. Any of the shows you hear where I'm giving all the information, or we're doing a quote or no quote show or a short show or something like that, or it's just me, it is literally word for word a script. And I have tried over the years to become more of a voice actor than I was ever before. So I hope it doesn't sound like I'm reading, but it was not only easier in terms of getting more stuff done and without mistakes and not having to edit it 60,000 times. But the analysis is better when I write it out.
Interesting.
So my question for you, I seem to be obsessed with your youth now, because the first thing I asked you was how old you were and when we were doing the subway, is how much your dad's career, and people, your listeners may not even know because you're very modest about it, your dad was and is a very important New York media figure, runs a show called Bronx Talk in New York. How did that affect your move into serious media and then into journalism?
He never one time said, you should do what I do. Never.
Wow.
Not one time for, you know, and I give him a lot of credit for that, because I think there is a natural tendency for fathers to want their sons to sort of take their path and then surpass what they have done. And maybe that's a natural way psychology works, but he never one time said, you should be in media like me. You should go out there and talk to people all day. But I was around it a lot. There are pictures of me at 3 and 4 years old in the basement of a school that he used to work at, behind the microphone, learning how microphones work and talking into them. I was always around when he was calling basketball games. I would be sitting next to him at the scorer's table, keeping score on a whiteboard for him so he knew how many points all the players had. I was always sitting in and watching him do his show, Bronx Talk. I ended up working at the TV station that he was working at because I found myself interested in it. But I will say, the moment that changed my life, I'll never forget it. I was sitting at 30 Rock. My dad was a producer at WNBC. I was sitting at 30 Rock and, you know, the news station, NBC4 in New York. And I was sitting there looking at the internal monitor that they have that you could change the channel and see all the different feeds that were coming in or going out. So one of the things you could see was all the different cameras in the studio and how all the cameras were set up and pointed at the anchors while they were reading. And I got this sort of behind the scenes feel of what the news business was like. And I mean, if you ever have an epiphany in life, this was it. I said to myself, as I was flipping those channels and looking at all these feeds coming in and out, the weather radar, the different cameras in the studio, stories coming in from the field, live shots, reporters waiting to do a live shot. And I was, I mean, I'm telling you, it was like that. It was like my life changed at that moment. And I knew from then on to this day what I wanted to be doing.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
Seriously, how many moments do you have like that in life? It was like, bam, I want to do this forever. Yeah. And I do. And I want to be a news reporter forever. I love it so much. All right. I'll do my next one here. Why do you think podcasts are such a good platform for doing history? What is it about the medium that lends itself to exploring and explaining a story from our past?
I think podcasts and the way they've developed and the ones that seem to be the most popular and get the most listeners are lengthy. They're at least a half an hour, and they almost all the good ones anyway go in depth. And one of the biggest things we like to say on the show and we like to talk about constantly, it's a drum we beat constantly, is that soundbite history that can be explained in a sentence or half a sentence or even worse, a slogan, is terrible and leads to all these misunderstandings, which then lead to misunderstandings about other things, particularly current affairs. And so with history, it's good to be able to talk about something that seems awfully narrow for a half an hour. And you can get into the weeds, and I mean that in a positive sense, you know, and give people detail. And I'm hoping that, and I think this is borne out by the fact that the show is popular, that people, when they listen to that, oh, things are really deeper and more complicated. And I think, you know, in all of our own lives, things are tremendously complicated. You've got bills to pay, you've got kids to raise, you're juggling a thousand things. But for some reason, we as a culture seem to want to have history give us only one answer. So-and-so was a good person, or so-and-so was a bad person, or this happened because of one reason, this happened because of another reason, you know. And it's never that way. And so I think you need the longer form of a podcast in order to get through the material so that people will understand it.
Yeah, you know, I also think that it really helps. It's sort of the magic of radio. It's the intimacy of the medium that, you know, the headphones are on or they're listening in their kitchen or something like that. And there's a real, even though it's recorded, there's a real relationship that the audience builds with the characters in the show, in this case, the host.
Yeah. And also a lot of my listeners are commuters and they, you know, it's like a little course for them, a little learning experience on the way to and from work.
Yeah. It's a wonderful medium in that sense, in that people can really fine tune what they're interested in and find a great show that they can commute with, but also do something positive during that commute. It's really cool.
Yeah. And I'm finding, and I think this is true across the podcast world, that during COVID, and I'm sorry that your show sort of started during COVID, podcast numbers are down because people aren't commuting as much. Streaming movies numbers are through the roof because everyone's home streaming Netflix or Hulu or whatever. but podcast numbers are down, but I hope that that will rebound.
That, for a lot of reasons, yeah.
You know, we're telling our listeners that you and I didn't share these questions beforehand, but they're going to start thinking we did, because my next question for you is almost exactly along these lines. And that is, why did you decide to start a podcast, okay, rather than a TV show or something that's more along what I think of as your generation's age, demographic, or whatever you call it, like a YouTube channel or something like that? You know, I think of podcasters as people my age and above, but you're not, and you're dealing with that, those two generations, older people and younger people.
For me, it was about the ease of getting it set up, and also it would fit into the rest of my life. And, you know, I work a 9-hour shift every day, and TV news requires even more hours than that, but that's sort of when I'm assigned to be there. But of course I spend other time, you know, more time working on it too. So I needed something that would fit in. And once you add video and once you add a more complicated setup, that time starts to grow exponentially. So for me, doing an audio podcast was something that I could start easily with just a few bucks. And then I wouldn't have to worry about the visual element of it.
Yeah.
And that was really big, because once the visual side comes in, and I know this from 15 years of doing TV, your commitment goes from, you know, from 1 to 5.
Yeah.
You know, or 1 to 7 or 8, because the visual part, and then you have to do more editing. It's just a whole different thing. So for me, the podcast thing was something that I could start easily, and not have to do the sort of legwork and the technical work that TV requires. So for me, it was just the right medium, because I could fit it into the rest of my life in the way that I chose to approach the show.
Yeah, well, I can chime in with that perfectly, because we have a YouTube channel, but I can't keep up with it. So you have to make the show, and then you make a video from the show, sort of like a Ken Burns video. And I've had to stop, because it was just, it was way, way too much work.
Yeah. The thing that takes me the most time is the preview clips that I put on Twitter and Instagram. That takes about an hour and a half for each episode.
Yeah.
And I have to do two of them today. So, all right, let me go to the next question. What process do you go through for deciding a show topic?
Well, I had a whole backlog of a bunch of myths that I already knew, right, that I wanted to bust. But then gradually, as I started to interview more historians, they would recommend other people doing other work. And so it sort of became just a, by hook or by crook, we decided to do certain shows at certain times. But then recently this year, especially this year, with so many things happening in current events, the Confederate statues coming down, the COVID related being sort of a parallel of the 1918 pandemic, and all that sort of thing, I'm really starting to think more about choosing topics that are related to what is going on or what is about to go on. So when we did those Confederate monument shows earlier this year, our numbers went through the roof. When we did that, we did two shows on the 1918 pandemic, and they went through the roof. So, for instance, my October shows, there's one on the Electoral College, there's one on fake news, there's one on, they're sort of geared toward the election, because not only will that get me more listeners, people have asked for that. Okay, people have especially asked for, give us the history of fake news in American journalism. We just recorded an interview with a great historian about that. So I'm trying.
There's a wonderful book out. Just real quick, there's a wonderful book out by Harold Holzer that describes every president's battles with the press. Right, it's really interesting. Right. But anyway, go ahead.
So I'm trying now to make it less of an historian's show, and more of a mixture of historians but historians talking about what's going on now, or talking about stuff that people can actually use as a background, as contextualization for the stuff they see and read in the news and the daily news.
In the news business, that's called a news peg. It's the question. Right. It's the answer to the question, why are we doing the story today?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, interesting answer.
Your first interview was with Kate Brower, the author of Team of Five, The President's Club in the Age of Trump. And that book's about, more or less, about retired presidents, you know, how they relate to each other. Why did you choose that author and that book?
That's a great question. So my favorite kind of history is presidential history. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to sort of start on friendly ground.
Yeah,
you
right,
know,
yeah.
If you're the host of the show, you get to be the master of who, you know, of who comes on. And I figured I wanted to talk presidential history first. And I also know Kate's books, and Kate's books are fantastic.
Right.
And she's done four or five of them now, one on the vice presidency, one on the residence, the White House residence, one on first ladies. This latest book in the President's Club in the Age of Trump, and the President's Club is just about how all the presidents sort of have relationships with each other and how the relationships have sort of risen and fallen as politics changes and as they change. So that was the first reason, is because I know presidential history pretty well. The second reason is because I know Kate's books very well. I've read them all. And the third reason is because I know she's a nice person.
Well, there you go.
She's a nice person. I'd interacted with her on Twitter a couple of times, and she was extremely gracious. And she, I think direct messaged her, or maybe I found her email and emailed her and said, "Hey, if you remember me, I'm starting a podcast. I'd love you to be the first guest." And I had written kind of a biography of myself and a description of what the show and a mission statement would be, or a mission statement of what the show would be. And she immediately responded almost right away and said, "Absolutely. I'd be honored to be your first guest." And so she came on, and that show was one of the two most listened to episodes that we have, because she is really, really good. And maybe the fourth reason is because she's media trained. She's done interviews on CNN and for the New York Times and all these other places. So she knows how to be interviewed, and it was just the perfect fit for the first show. And I'm definitely going to invite her on again, because she really is such a pleasure to interview, and she really knows so much and has interviewed them all too. That was a big thing too, that she's interviewed the presidents also.
Right.
So that kind of thing you can't replace.
I think media trained is such an important thing, and it's an important phrase people don't realize. We just interviewed in August, we had Martha Jones on the show, Dr. Martha Jones, whose new book Vanguard, about African-American women and their struggles to get the vote. I actually interviewed her right after she got off of an interview with Hillary Rodham Clinton on, I think, a PBS or a CNN special. So she did the interview with them, and then switched right over to the Zoom interview with me. And that just the fact that she had done, she of course did a lot of this stuff in the past. She was media trained, or media savvy, or media used to be media. It made the show go great, and also, but most importantly, of course, her content was fabulous. But it certainly helps with the editing, because then it becomes less of an editing job.
Yeah, right. That was one of the goals of my show, that is maybe the main goal of the show, which is that I bring a little bit of a different perspective to it, because I'm an interviewer for a mass audience, and I do stories for a mass audience, as opposed to two professors talking, which is great and fine. And you certainly know more than I do, and professors know much more than me about what has happened, and also how to sort of process the content in a little bit of a different way. But that also, the reverse then is also true, that I do things a little bit differently.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the hook of the show is just sort of that this is an interview done for a mass audience, because that's just what I'm trained in and what I do every day. You know, neither's right or wrong. It's just, you know, it's just the way I approach the show. All right, let me do the next question. Okay. How do you evaluate whether a show met its goals?
Ooh, that's a toughie. First of all, we don't get near, I don't know how this is going with you, but we don't get nearly as much comment from listeners as I'd like to get.
I get almost none.
It's really surprising. I get, you know, if I get five comments on across Twitter and Facebook and email, I'm stunned about one episode. So I'm gauging it by the numbers of downloads, and for those of you out there who are, don't know much about the background of podcasting, downloads is the number of listens by individual people, and also by the number of, you know, shares on Twitter and things like that, or shares on Facebook, finding that Facebook is a much more effective platform for me than Twitter or Instagram, probably because of an age thing, generation thing. Well, when certain groups, for instance, if I do a show about a certain topic that has contemporary political comment, sometimes certain groups will jump on and flame me. But that's, even that's pretty rare. In fact, I'd welcome a lot more of it, you know, say, because of course they don't know what they're talking about, and I'm the one who's explaining it. But generally it has to, it's purely just a numbers game. And when we have sponsors, which we've had in the past, you know, they don't want to hear about, oh, so-and-so likes the show, or we got this famous historian. They want to know how many people listen to the show. So unfortunately, in a way, I'm getting good information for of one type, but not the kind of information that I would want or that you would want.
But do you ever sit there and think to yourself, you know, I didn't quite get that the way I wanted to, or maybe I should have said this a little bit more clearly, because I know that I do all the time.
Yeah, sometimes, and I'll even cancel a show. We had a show, I can't give away the topic because the person will know and I'll be embarrassed, where the expert showed up not only unprepared, but way out of date in terms of the research that's been done on this topic. And I did the interview, and I knew almost immediately while the interview was going on, this isn't going to work. And then my sponsor said, that was a terrible show. What, you know, what were you thinking? Your questions were terrible. His answers were terrible. Her answers were terrible. We're not going to run our ad on that episode. So I had to
that turn answers around. The question right
I,
there.
Yeah, I had to turn around and say to the person, I'm sorry. And I blame myself. I said, I should have looked into this more and blah, 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 blah. So
interesting.
I've had to cancel shows before they go out because they just weren't good enough, but that's fairly rare. I like to think that I do my homework in getting the right person for the right topic.
All right, fire away. You're up.
Oh, my turn. Yeah, my turn. Why is presidential history your favorite type of history?
I don't know. I don't know. I know that I first got into it when my Aunt Linda, who is a listener of the show, and she'll probably hear this.
Hi, Aunt Linda.
Hello. She got me, I don't even know if she remembers this, she got me a poster that had all the president's faces on it and the time, mm-hmm. the time period that they served, you know, the years that they served. And I remember just gazing at it and staring at it. And then there was also one other feature. The presidents that died in office were shaded in blue, and the presidents who were assassinated were shaded in red.
Yikes.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's the best thing for a kid to
no,
see.
No, a little kid, no.
But I remember staring at it. No, that's fine, Aunt Linda. That's okay. I recovered. But, well, maybe I didn't recover since I'm here doing the show with a room full of books. I remember then learning about the assassinations and why had Lincoln been shot and who shot him and why had Kennedy been shot mm-hmm. and who shot him. And then I remember seeing the Zapruder film and realizing that this was an important person and the power that they had. And then I think I just got into the idea that that it really does sometimes take someone in the middle of everything to steer the ship. And some of them are a lot better at it than others. And
right.
You know, the energy of the president radiates to all of us. It's like a bicycle spoke, you know? So I think that might just be a way to answer the question, which is, I was just fascinated by this one person out of all 330 million of us. I guess back then it might've been 230 million or 245 million. Just the fact that there's one person that gets to have Secret Service and gets to, gets to give the State of the Union and gets to submit bills and gets to talk to other nations and gets to do foreign policy and gets to command the military and gets to speak for the nation in a time of difficulty. So that might be the answer as to why I'm the answers to why I'm most interested in presidential history. Well,
and it is important. It's an important topic. It's not like you're interested in the difference of railway gauges around the world or some sort of small minor thing.
One day, my last question might be how you came up with that one, railway gauges. That's pretty good. That's a deep poll there. That's what they call a deep poll. It's a deep poll. Then I'll ask a similar question then. Is there a favorite time period that you have to cover?
Well, that is a very good question, and that's getting more interesting the further along I do the show. My research, my professional research in academic history was in Britain and Ireland during the 1830s and 1840s. And that's what my first book was on and blah, 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 blah. But trust me, no one wants to hear about the what was known as the appropriation of excess revenues from the Church of Ireland to secular purposes, right? That bill of 1833 doesn't win me very many conversation friends at dinner.
But you did memorize it.
But I did memorize. Oh yeah, I can tell you more about you people want to commit suicide after listening to me for 5 minutes on this. So when I came to craft the show, I just go, oh, we'll do all periods of history, but just by happenstance or whatever, we have concentrated on modern history, and more I've become interested in this period from say 1900 to 1950, because so many world-changing things happen, so many awful things happen, and there's so much media attention, and by media I'm including film and television in there, on World War II and on things like that, that I've kind of shifted periods. It's what not only what happened, but I'm interested in why World War II is presented in the various ways it's presented.
So World War II.
I don't want to say that I'm not a research 20th centuryist. I'm a research 19th centuryist, but I'm a podcast and popular history 20th centuryist. Is that?
Yeah, no.
Saying 20th centuryist probably sounds really boring and really nerdy, but that's the way we are.
Hey, we all need a job. We all need a title, right? That's a good one. All right, fire away. You're up.
Okay, now we're getting into the weeds, folks. You and I have both interviewed Dr. Sarah Mylov, the author of The Cigarette, A Political History, a great book, Buzzkillers, Axel Bankers, go out and buy it. Did you listen to my show with her? And if you did, how did your interview differ from mine?
See, this is a good reason to ask the questions ahead of time, because then I would have. I did not know that you'd listened to her, that you had interviewed her. And I'm embarrassed to say that the audio from my side on that episode was wrong, what was bad. And I actually apologized to her for it, because when I recorded from the wrong mic. And that's something that you learn whenever you start a podcast or any type of show or anything in life, that you will make mistakes. So,
And also that I was surprised that in doing all this, that the technical aspects of stuff can have such major knock-on effects.
Huge. Yeah, it's huge.
It's just this minor technical things can ruin a show.
Yeah, and I almost didn't release it, but she spent her time and it wasn't that bad. And it's actually done very well. The show has been downloaded a ton of times.
It's a great book. It's just a great book.
It's a great book. And she was such a gracious guest to come on. And I did apologize to her about the audio. And I will apologize right now. So sorry, Professor Mylov. But be that as it may, unfortunately, I didn't listen to your episode with her. And I didn't realize that there was one. But I will say the reason that the book, The Cigarette, is so great, and there are a few reasons, but maybe the biggest reason that it's so great is that this is a product that we are all intimately familiar with in one way or another. And who knew that there was this 125 years or 130 years of history behind the people, the effort that has been made to put those things in the hands of everyday Americans?
Yeah.
To me, that was it really hammered home, like, wow, this is a setup. This is something that has been done to us.
Right.
So anyway, it's a great book, and I would love to hear your impressions of her.
Well, it's a great
of her. Yeah.
It's by the way, listeners should know the full title is The Cigarette, A Political History. Right. And that's why it's so fascinating. And the book is so good. I did two shows with her in her office at the University of Virginia. This is back when we could travel. I remember those days. In which we talked about the Surgeon General's 1964 report saying that cigarettes cause cancer. And also this conceptual thing I just love. It's one of the reasons I'm not a research historian anymore. I'm just not as good at it as most people. She has a chapter, maybe a couple chapters, on the making of the non-smoker. The non-smoker is a sort of type of—
That was a great chapter, yeah.
Type of person. And my parents were non-smokers. And I remember in the late 60s and the 70s, you know, they would not have ashtrays in the house. And when we had parties, which they had all the time, people had to go outside and smoke. And when we went to other people's houses, there were ashtrays everywhere and on and on and on and on and on. And I didn't really think about that as a way of living. It was just the way it was. And the way she analyzes that is just genius.
Brilliant.
Just
brilliant.
Absolute
brilliant.
Genius.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And it is a sect of people. Non-smokers had to become, as opposed to the smokers taking charge, it was the non-smokers saying, we have a right to live healthily.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant piece of analysis, yes.
And I lived through enough of it. I mean, I was still in graduate school in England, and people were, you could smoke anywhere you wanted still. So I remember, you know, before California, for instance, went smoke-free. I certainly remember before New York went smoke-free.
And I remember do too. Before England I remember it a little bit, yeah.
So, you know, it's perhaps the biggest change in social habits, certainly in my lifetime.
But I might argue the cell phone changed social habits.
Well, that's probably true too,
But yes, the smoking thing is a big deal. All right, if you could interview one person in history, who would it be?
Oh, in history. Oh, Lordy.
Well, let's do the general U.S. history.
Oh, U.S. history. Martin Luther King. And the reason I say that is because the more I've gotten into trying to understand why he's such an icon, actually, the more I've come to admire him. Now, we've done several shows on Martin Luther King, and one of the ones we did was busting down the myths of how popular he was, the extent that everyone followed him, et cetera, et cetera. The idea that within the African American community, within the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, that it was all, everyone was united and all believed the same thing and followed it. You know, there was a lot of disagreement, discord, and a lot of other important leaders that got forgotten after Dr. King's assassination. And the more I've looked into it, the more I have. And usually, when you look into people, you know, you find them become, the myths get stripped away, and you think, well, that's not so good. I mean, you know, Patton is tremendously overrated as a tank commander. Churchill is tremendously overrated in almost every way possible. I've come to think, and I'm not finished with this by any means. It'll take me years to finish with that. Martin Luther King is actually underrated, and at least to me, and that's been a major eye opener for me.
So, what question do you have? A single question you would ask him?
Yes. How in the world could he have given those speeches he gave? Again, this is another big thing of mine, where all we ever hear are the snippets, the inspirational snippets. Right. But when you listen to the whole speech, and when the riot of the languages. Right is the language of the unheard, quote, began flying around the internet during the various disturbances we've had earlier this year. I put out a show where I said, listen to this entire speech. This is like an hour and 10-minute speech. And he talked in detail about the consumer boycotts, about the various aspects of the civil rights work during the middle 60s, and on and on and on and on and on, and how there were two Americas. And only at the very end do you get the sort of uplifting moments. So how in the world he thought people would sit through an hour-long speech that was, in my rough estimation, 85% technical detail. I mean, I think it's glorious. I listened to it, and it's incredible. There are all these things going on. He's delegating different things to Jesse Jackson or Ralph Abernathy or whoever. And it just shows this immense amount of work that he's doing and all these other people are doing. That's another thing we always stress is that there are, you know, it's never just one person, always a large team. And yet he's able to build all that up into a crescendo of the things we always hear on in soundbite history. And I don't mean to cheapen the idea of the great sayings that he's great things he said in those inspirational moments, but I do mean to say that people really should listen to the fuller speeches, because you'll get so much more information and you'll get a much greater impression and appreciation of what was actually going on.
Yeah. Headlines certainly don't.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't
soundbite history.
Whole...
Headline history doesn't help us.
Can I answer my own question real quick?
Yeah,
real quick. Abraham Lincoln, and I would ask the question: how were you so strong?
Well, that's a good one. I would have asked him, how would you have handled Reconstruction? Because everyone's dying to know
very
that.
Good question. Right. And unfortunately, we will never know that.
Maybe the night of April 14th. Hey. What do you say we stay home and watch the ball game and not go to the theater?
Yeah. Or what? Maybe we ask the bodyguard to stick around a little longer. And then maybe I'll answer the other question real quick too. My favorite time period to cover is Reconstruction.
Yeah.
Maybe I should have thought a little bit more deeply about that. I probably would ask, how would you have handled Reconstruction? And maybe another question for Lincoln would be, looking back now, of course he can't, but if you could look back, would you have picked someone different to be on your ticket as opposed to Andrew Johnson?
Yes, Lord.
Now, maybe Johnson was needed to win the election, but maybe it wasn't the best choice.
Because of the Tennessee thing, yeah.
Because he didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
And he was, he knew what he was doing, and he certainly revealed himself to be a racist and not particularly helpful. So, all right.
My turn.
Is it me?
No,
you're up.
I think
go
I'm up.
Please. Yeah, you're up, yeah.
One of your best shows, I think, was your interview with Chris McGreal, who wrote a book called American Overdose. It's about addiction in our country and the recent history of addiction. How difficult, now you read the book beforehand, obviously, but how difficult was it to listen to him talk about that topic, to listen to him and analyze it on the show? It bothered me. That book was a great book, and it really bothered me because it's so much more extensive than most of us think. But I think actually having to hear someone walk through the analysis would be even more disheartening. Sorry to be such a downer, but I am Professor Buzzkill.
First of all, I want to, Chris was really a very generous and very nice person to be on the show, particularly early on when you really don't have a lot of credibility. And I've only, 13, 14, 15 episodes in. But Chris was very nice to be on the show, and he spent a lot of time with me. And I'm going to say something that might knock your socks off a little bit. It was even more difficult for me than you think, because I had a cousin die of an opioid overdose.
Yeah.
Wow. So not only am I listening to him give this history of how these drugs were put purposely into the hands of people who would be most susceptible to being addicted to them, but also the fact that they made money doing it, big money doing it. People made a lot of money to put these drugs into our streets and into our homes. But it was particularly painful because, I essentially know that these are the people who whose product led to the death of someone I loved. So that was a very difficult thing. I will also, maybe I'll knock your socks off again, because of my day job, I hear a lot of misery.
Yeah.
And I'm around it quite often. So maybe it doesn't quite have the psychological impact in short bursts the way it might for other people, because I'm just around it all the time. I've sort of built up the idea that I'm going to hear something painful and that I just need to do my job, which is to conduct an interview. I mean, when I've looked, I've looked at literally people who have lost loved ones hours before and interviewed them at length and built relationships with them that have stayed sometimes for weeks and years. So maybe I'm just used to that, but it's interesting that you brought that up, because it is a good reminder that sometimes the content that I am and that we are surrounded by is painful and can have lasting impacts. So that's the answer to that question. Two answers that maybe you weren't expecting. If you could give the United States a do-over in one thing, what would it be?
Well, obviously Reconstruction. I just think Reconstruction and Jim Crow are really the worst things that ever happened to. I mean, slavery is obviously the worst thing, but in terms of the America's already had slavery by the times the United States started. So Reconstruction and Jim Crow, it's just it. And this is another thing. It's like World War II and studying the Nazis, and it's like studying Stalin. It's like studying Mao. It just gets worse and worse and worse. The more detail you get, and you keep searching and hope for some light at the end of the tunnel. But just the sick hatred, and the lynching of American servicemen who happen to be African American, coming off the trains in their little southern towns in their uniforms after World War II in uniform, and getting lynched. It just rips your heart out.
That is painful. And also for me, when I think about the efforts that were made to keep people from voting.
Yes. Yeah.
That is particularly, it rips your soul out. It just, when you hear the stories of people who, whatever it is, can you read the last sentence? Can you read, what is the last word in this sentence? And all these trick questions of what, how many jelly beans are in this jar? And by the way, you need to have a sponsor.
Yeah.
But the sponsor has to be a voter, and the sponsor can't sponsor more than one person. What a horrific thing to go through, and what a destructive, horrible thing that we are still living with, the legacy living with. And I don't even know that it's a legacy, because some certainly argue that it's going on right now.
Well, and if you think about that as a Jim Crow phenomenon, it even goes well up to within living memory. I mean, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is passed within my lifetime, barely within my lifetime. I was only two. But, you know, these things are very, very recent. And
there's a fight going on over it right now.
Over right now, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've talked about some very bracing things, but let me ask you some sort of more technical things, more to podcasting things. Have your guests recommended your podcast to other writers? And has this helped build your interview list and future episode list?
I don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
But I do know that after I started getting decent reviews on Twitter from people who had been guests on the show, that it suddenly got a little bit easier to book guests, that it suddenly, you know, it suddenly got like, okay, I can see that this person has said this about the show. This is a credible person. I can go on the show. Right. And I think that might even be more important given when you start dealing with publicists, because they don't really know you. They don't really, you know, they're not necessarily in the same community on Twitter that I'm in. So when they go on to my profile and see, okay, this person said this about his show, this person said that about his show, yeah, I can provide my author to him.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I found that publicists, and authors recommending authors have been a tremendous help.
Yeah. I'll go here. Is there a type of question that you think is particularly effective during your interviews?
Oh, I suppose the type of question that's particularly interview effective is the one that actually, after you have the person explain the background, the historical background of whatever their specialty is, the one question, however I phrase it or however it comes up in the discussion, that gets them to talk then about their contribution to the research and their specific work is the one that really makes the show. Because that's what they're the expert in. You know this because you're interviewing experts on certain things, and that's the tipping point. And that's why I try to keep the background part to 5 minutes, and jump right into stuff.
Yeah.
All right. I have another
number nine, or is this
this
10?
Is nine. This is nine. I have another technical question. You've sort of been answering this as we go along, and I have been too, but. How has your broadcasting experience helped you starting help you start a podcast, especially from the technical side of things. And please provide us one funny story, one technical goof, one screw up, one, you know, I don't know, blooper that you've had to deal with.
Meaning in my TV life?
Both. Yeah. Either or and everything.
I think from a technical perspective, I knew how much work for the most part it would be. So I knew that that it will take me this much editing and this much time because I've spent so much time around it. But really the technical thing was I got to have a good mic and I have to know how to use the software, the editing software properly.
Right.
That was a big thing. But I've spent so much time around it that in some ways it's like breathing to me. I mean, picking out sound bites is something I pick out. I mean, I pick out a dozen of them a day, and I have been doing that for 15 years. Yeah. So I think even more important than the technical side was how to interview people and how to use questions to drive a discussion and to really get, you know, if you were to see my preparation sheets, I really do prepare in a very diligent fashion. Sure. Because I can't go into an interview unprepared.
Yeah, you're a pro.
And particularly when you're interviewing people who know as much as our guests know, you don't want to sound stupid.
No, not at all.
To them. And our guests are just brilliant. I mean, the authors, you know, I said the other day to somebody I was interviewing, I was like, this was not during the show, this was after. I was like, how do you remember all this? How do you have this on? She said, well, you know, we're around it a lot. So I guess it's the same thing that we all have in our lives. But I'm just blown away by the brilliance of these authors and of how much they know and their contribution to scholarship. I mean, what geniuses they are. Truly, it is a blessing to be around them and to be given the right to interview them.
And the fact that they care about it. They care about the fact that this is important information. This is what people should know.
Who's your dream guest?
Right now, my dream guest is Dr. Heather Cox Richardson. Last year, before her media career expanded dramatically, I asked her to be on a show explaining the electoral college, and then I screwed up the scheduling and I let balls drop and all kinds of other stuff. So now she's become much too busy for me. But I wanted her before the election, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen. But also because exactly what you say, she's deep, deep knowledge and also cares about the fact that this stuff matters and very media savvy.
She's just a brilliant person.
Absolutely,
I mean, totally. How else to say it. Her letters to an American are popular for a very good reason.
I said to someone the other day, not only is she one of the most important historians, she's one of the most important intellectuals in the country. You know,
I don't like to put
rankings on things, but she's certainly top five intellectuals.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. Am I allowed to answer my own question?
Yeah.
Robert Caro, the author of the Lyndon Johnson books.
Yeah.
My favorite author, always will be. But I don't want to interrupt him from work on volume five.
Yes, because he's so in depth. It's just fabulous.
I know.
And
the writing is so good. Every sentence is so nice. Yeah. Okay, number 10, is this
it? Okay, this is it. This is it. And this is a doozy. This is going to show your listeners what sort of nice and modest person you are. You're an Emmy Award winner.
Oh, geez.
Why don't you mention that in your show description of the podcast website? I'm super jealous. And by the way, Axel Bankers, the Emmy that he won, it was about a story he did on a historical topic. So it's not just because...
My Emmy is in history.
It's not because of the hurricane of whatever, okay?
The reason is because I didn't get into the TV business to win Emmy Awards. I didn't get in it to win awards. It's nice to win them. I submit for them sometimes. It's just not something that I need to fluff my feathers with. I would rather people say about a story that doesn't go viral and doesn't change the world. I would rather people say to me, boy, that was a really good story you did. Thank you.
Well,
to me, that is... You know, I wrote one yesterday that went out yesterday, and it's just about a teacher who was painting with some students a mural in St. Petersburg. And I hope they like the story.
Yeah.
Really, that's why I got into it, is because I love writing and I love telling the stories, and I love, I guess a certain part of me enjoys being the sort of performer and going out. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean performer that I'm making it up. I just mean the, you know,
yeah, the on-camera
act
presence
of delivering the news. Yeah. The on-camera. I like that part of it. And I sort of like the position that it puts you in a community, or in a neighborhood, or in a TV market. And I don't mind having a profile. I like having a bit of a profile, but the Emmy thing, it was a nice moment. It's great, but you know, you can't get into the business to win Emmy awards. If they happen, that's great. And I know people who have won 60 and 70 of them.
Oh, okay.
And they're brilliant people. But for me, I'd rather people say, you know, that guy's a good reporter. Guy's a real good reporter. The story that he wrote was really, really good. And I'm really thankful that he spent time with our family to tell our family story. To me, that's all I need.
Well, that's a very good and heartening way to describe the passion you put into your work.
Well, I appreciate that. All right. Here's my number 10 question. If in 1,000 years, or whenever the next civilization takes over, and they are, they're in some giant nation state that spans half the globe and whatever, and the aliens are also here, and we're all hobnobbing with them, and people are digging through the remnants of the American civilization, or of whatever civilization we're in right now, and they find a computer that is, for whatever reason, queued up to Professor Buzzkill's podcast, mm-hmm. and they press play. What do you want future civilizations to have said to say about your podcast?
Well, that they loved it, that he should have gotten an Emmy. But more importantly, that some of the things he's trying to get across, and perhaps the most important one, is that the great man theory, the great person theory, the great individual theory of history just isn't true and is damaging, right? Really should be part of, really, or at least was part of, became part of the conversation eventually. And that details matter. Context matters. Complication matters. I've just getting into the weeds is not a waste of time. And I think that's what we try to do. And I know you do, because you interview your guests at length. And that this person obviously knew that, and obviously thought that would have some societal benefit. Mm. So, but still,
that's what Professor Buzzkill's left
behind. I'd still rather have an Emmy and all the sweet, sweet cash that comes along with it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, this has been just a pleasure. So much fun. Thank you for listening. Professor Buzzkill, you want to take us
out?
Yes,
thank you so much, all you Axel Mankers out there and Buzzkillers out there. This show is roughly an hour, and it's the fastest hour I've ever spent, because it's been so good and so interesting. And if you don't subscribe to either of our shows, you should subscribe to both. That didn't come out the right way.
Subscribe.
But yeah, subscribe to both. And
it was perfect.
Rate us and review us on all the various platforms.